This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. About a month ago, we got word that Indiana Landmarks had chosen this year's recipient of the Williamson Prize for Outstanding Leadership in Historic Preservation. It'll go to former Indiana First Lady Judy O'Bannon. Today, we're spending the hour with her. Judy O'Bannon, welcome to All In.
Thank you. Well, thanks for having me.
And if you have questions or comments for the former First Lady, find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a short voicemail at 866-476-3881. Again, that's 866-476-3881. Now, first off, I feel like we need to address the passing of former Governor Joe Kernan, who died early this morning and who took office after your husband Frank's death in 2003. What do you remember about Joe Kernan?
Well, you know, we really did lose a friend to Indiana and a real public servant. And this morning, reminiscing, thinking in my mind, talking to friends and coworkers on the phone has been an affirming thing for me. We'll miss Joe, and oh, he had so many years we thought he could delight us and also help and inform us. But he left with me the feeling that, yes, public service is an honorable serving. And he was mayor of South Bend for three terms. Gosh, his last election, he won by 82%. That's pretty unprecedented. Showed that people thought he kept the city going well. And then he was lieutenant governor for those 7 years and jumped right in when Frank died suddenly. That's no small thing to shift your staff, thinking to figure out who's going to do what and how and what are the policies in place. And he took that right up. He was amidst it all, just a congenial and caring person that he'd been all the time I'd known him. But he was that way with our family during our time when we were trying to figure out what's next. So I've been thinking about him this morning, and it is affirming. It fits right in my mind with historic preservation. Because he is a big influence on my life. It's what came before today that helped form me to where I am today, all those people I worked with. And I think that historic preservation is saying we didn't just arrive on this planet alone this moment, but that we do stand on the shoulders of giants and events that happened before. And knowing them helps us understand ourselves today a lot better. It's not just about saying, oh, I can't give up Grandma's old quilt or her Victorian house because I like Grandma and it brings back warm memories. It's not just about, oh, I like a certain period in history. I like those buildings. I love those arches. It's not just about beauty. But historic preservation to me is about how we fit into the cosmos. Oh, it's such a complex and diverse and interrelated web of life, just to see how we fit into that total gives us the answer to where are we today. You know, I can look at myself and say where I am. It's sort of, for me, it's a bit securing and hopeful to see I'm not alone, that I am held almost in the bosom of the history of heroes, of people like Joe Kernan, who suffered in the Korean War in a prison camp 11 months.
Vietnam War, yeah.
Yeah, oh, yes, I had him in the wrong place, didn't I? wherever the place was, it was not a happy place. And the man that shared that small cell with him has said that he kept the two of them going for those 11 months by playing games, by making up things to remember, by reminiscing, talking together. To know that is an affirming thing, and it places me in the time in history. And it caused me to then be able to reach out and say, okay, if I'm here today because of all the people that did things before me, where do I want to go in the future? Where do I want my country to be? Where do I want life to be? Where do I want thinking and technology to be? And then you got to say to yourself, well, if that's where I want to be, how am I going to get there? So I think of historic preservation as more than just saving an old building. I think it's giving us a place that we fit in total life.
Well, is it the echo of the people who made that place possible? Is there a feeling that comes with that context?
Well, yeah, there's certainly a feeling that comes with that. I live down here when I'm in Corydon in an old barn in a log cabin. And the cabin was built in 1830, and then I restored it. And then the barn was 1866. When I'm here at night and I can look through those logs, because the barn is placed with an outer shell, so to speak, that stands away from those logs, I just feel like I can hear the spirits of people that went through all the pioneers did to sort of settle this land on these hills and down here where there's a spring. It's why the cabin was built here originally, a spring. You got to have water. That's life, isn't it? It's what builds us. Our environment is part of all this historic preservation. We got settled because there was a buffalo trace across the Ohio River. And if you got water and you have buffaloes going across, you probably have other wildlife. So people settled there. They found food there. They found transportation there. The little spring outside my cabin is why people were here, Native Americans. We walk in the fields and I find shards from flint where the Native Americans had actually what they thought of as factories. They made flint up in a rough form and they shipped that. That was their form of trade out in the East Coast. They find Harrison County flint. That ties me into how people have always connected with nature, with animals, with the water, the soil, the sky, and it connects me with people seeking out other forms of life and called humans. So we humans, we built buildings, and then I'm not the first to say this. We build our buildings, and then they form us. That environment impacts how we feel about ourselves, how we can interact, what's needed that we need to do, what's hopeful and purposeful and jazzes up our brains and spirits and gets us going.
What do you know about the history of the barn there where you live?
Well, I know a whole lot. You know, well, I'd probably be bored with it. If you come to my farm, you have to get the lecture on it.
I look forward to it.
The loft barn itself was built in 1866 by a man who came back from the Civil War. He and his brother both been in prison in the Andersonville prison, and his brother died there. He came back into Perry County and built this building. It served all the needs of that small little community by Bandon. It had attached buildings that would come on over the years. You know, they needed a granary, so they patched a building on the outside. They maybe got pigs that they didn't have before, and so they put a little pig shed on it, or there was a blacksmith shop. So you could read a building. You know, you can read a building, and you can tell its history. You can read a house and know what was important to people and what they had to do to survive and how it served them, what they thought was important or what they didn't think was important. You can look, oh, gosh, it's like a Victorian house or like this log building. So we had the little cabin that I've restored before. It's always been on this location, and we needed a little more space, so we went out looking for some patch logs and happened upon this barn. It went 125 feet with all the stuff. Oh, gosh, it was so much fun to restore. The cabin was, too. I'm not an engineer. I'm not a trained architect. And I so appreciate those professions tolerating an amateur like me who waded in and got the thrill of tinkering in their professions. And, you know, if you make a mistake and you're restoring your own building, well, you pay the cost in whatever respect that mistake might lead you. It was just a playful, you know, I'd get on, advertise in our little newspaper, I needed something, and 10 people would respond. They didn't have what I was asking for, but maybe they had some boards that they'd had in their barn forever, and the brother says, oh, sell those little boards, or bricks that we collected. We just collected all old stuff. I found places and brought it in there, and then I got to use the most fun thing of all, my imagination. How am I going to use this in this building? When we took the barn down, we took every single thing, every nail we could conjure, every board, and I first thought I just wanted the logs. But as I watched them be lifted from their place, by these big canvas straps that we use. Those logs became real living members of a unit, of a living thing, a barn that serviced people. And so I knew they had to go up like I took them down. So we tried to replicate exactly two cribs, an upper floor, and a dog trough, and use every single piece of wood and metal that we took out of those barns. I think this love of old stuff was sort of in my DNA. My mom always said, you don't have to go to a fancy place to find something of beauty. It's everywhere. So looking at this old barn when we saw it in the field, the roof was caving in, you know, and I said to Frank, well, we're just going to go look at it. But we did just happen to take an Amish carpenter and some guys with trucks with us, and he wrote. So when we got down there, Frank wrote the contract on sitting on the steps. And the next day, I was down there with the crew. We were taking it down, and I knew it had to go back up in the same shape. It's a living organism. So just living within that, we've been down here to avoid the pandemic of the COVID-19.
Sure.
And so that Don, age 90 plus, and me, 85 plus, are pretty isolated. And I think being in this enclosure in logs, you know, it's wood right out of the woods. Wood. I feel like I'm one of the animals living in my native habitat. I feel the presence of civilizations before. I feel the fact that funny stuff happens to people. Times when, you know, they, like this barn has been here since long before the 1918 and 17 flu. It stood, it's taken its licks, but it's still there. And that gives me perspective.
We're talking to former Indiana First Lady Judy O'Bannon about her work in historic preservation, which has earned her the Indiana Landmarks Williamson Prize for 2020. We welcome your questions and comments for the former First Lady. We're with her for the entire hour. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881, 866-476-3881. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in just 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today, we're glad to have former Indiana First Lady Judy O'Bannon with us. Her husband, Frank O'Bannon, served as governor of Indiana from 1997 until his death in 2003. We welcome your questions and comments this hour. We're on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881, 866-476-3881. We'd love to hear your voice in the conversation today. So, Judy O'Bannon, we're talking primarily about historic preservation today. And as we've heard, you're so good at illustrating the feeling that that someone gets, particularly that you get, because I guess it's a little bit different for everybody. So let's talk about Indiana landmarks. You're receiving the Williamson Prize, which was named after their past president, Reed Williamson, who you worked with very closely for a long time. What was the organization like at that time when he was president?
Well, I thought he was remarkable. I think before then, historic preservation, and specifically saving downtown Indianapolis, people cared. But we'd gone through the 1960s where the idea of renovation was you get your bulldozer out and you smash everything and you start from scratch. You know, the English Theater that used to be on the Circle had just been felled when I, as a teenager, was moved to Indianapolis with my dad's work. And I used to transfer buses down there to get from Shortridge. If I went down to work at L.S. Ayers as a kid and then home. And I'd listen on the bus stop to people talking about that building used to be over there. It was so ornate, you know. It was beautiful. And I just would wonder, what was that like? Why did I miss that? My mother and my dad didn't talk in terms of historic preservation. We always had lived in sort of an old house that my dad rebuilt, but modern. And but somehow they got across to me that there was something of value in looking at what was around. And so I sort of carried that in there undeveloped for a good many years. And Reed Williamson, when I first began to work with him, he drew that out in a more organized way. I think he did that for Indiana Historic Preservation, too. He made it more professional. He gave passion to it. He was a great strategist, and he could run a meeting better than anybody I've ever known. I'd come out of his meetings and say, why do I stay on this board? I've been on it so long. Why do I keep coming here? Why do I want to go to these board meetings? He knew how to include the staff, so they had input, but he knew what kinds of things to say for board members so that they felt they were involved, had responsibilities, and had input. He was a great strategist. He was a lot of fun for me to be around talk. And he really helped figure out how to save the facades for Circle Center Mall. That was quite a controversy. You know, School 5 had been knocked down by bulldozers in preservationist mind in the middle of the night, and all those rogues. And they got a court order, stopped it the next morning. There it sat, right down there on Washington, about now where the State Museum is, and had a chain-link fence around it. Just looked awful, and it just reminded you of dreams or hopes or lives lost. Was a sad thing. And it was in almost lawsuits. What are we going to do about this? Do you take the same thing? Do you take it down or do you preserve it? It had been a school that many people identified with some of our early settler immigrant, not the first early settler, but a stage of immigration into Indianapolis area. And, of course, a lot of myth gets built about that, too, that maybe was romantic to talk about, but maybe it was a little more fantasy. But it became a touchstone about what's going to happen there. And it took tough negotiations between the city and historic landmarks. No longer were they just little old ladies in tennis shoes that liked old stuff and ran antique stores, but they were lawyers, they were thinkers, they were activists, they were political people, and they put their heads together and they put muscle behind it, the landmarks people did, and they came up with the compromise of saving the facades and putting them back on the outer frame of our Circle Center Mall. It gives our downtown character. It gives it depth of history and understanding of permanence in the retail business and in the building of a good trade in a commercial area. And also in that was the State Museum, and I was on their board at that time too, that we would incorporate the front wall that had started to be demolished, incorporate that into the new State Museum building that would go on that site, and that within those walls would be school programs for kids, as that was School Number 5, and it would stay a learning place. So Reed Williamson took us through those tough times where you could have just had a whole bunch of people just mad and not very positive and constructive. He worked that out with city people and with his board members and the skill of those people. I had great respect and admiration and awe about that. Many of you aren't old enough to remember, but we went months and maybe years with holes in downtown where they had knocked down old stuff and nothing was in there because funding didn't come or because plans weren't done or things got out of sync. And we made it through that a stronger organization, but more than that, a stronger city.
I want to make sure that we get to a little more on saving downtowns, because that's a big part of your historic preservation work. But I want to make sure that we get to this listener voicemail from William, who says, Judy, that he knew you when you and your husband first moved to Indianapolis. Let's listen.
This is William from Indianapolis. I just wanted to make a comment. I first met Judy O'Bannon when she and Frank first moved to Indianapolis, and they moved into a wonderfully restored house in the old North Side. I worked for the Preservation Commission at that time, and instead of, you know, them throwing their weight around, wanting to know if they could skirt the the regulations and so on. They invited me and the staff architect to go to their house, and they asked us questions and how to proceed, and they were just so gracious and wonderful. And the other thing is they got it. They understood the value of historic preservation and also working in a and living in a preservation commission regulated district, which is the Old North Side here in Indianapolis. So it was just a wonderful thing. First it was Judy, and then we were honored, and then the treat. The icing on the cake is when his honor, then Lieutenant Governor Frank O'Bannon, came and then asked us more questions. And it was a delight. It really was. I can't say enough good things about Judy and historic Indiana, and in getting it, realizing that those are important things here in our throughout the state. Thank you.
Thank you, William. And Judy, were you able to hear that phone call okay?
Well, you know, I'm just this old lady, and my hearing aids, my phone comes in through my hearing aids. So if somehow you get too much volume or you don't get too much volume, some of it cracks.
Aha, gotcha.
What I got from William is that we were walking the same path of trying to figure out how to save the Old North Side at a time when it had gone through those first early pioneers, urban pioneers who were living amidst sometimes many family and apartment units in a single family home, and gunshot wounds on weekends, and sort of stuff that was big weeds in the vacant lots where buildings had been knocked down. So we moved in after that first wave of enthusiasm of people who didn't care if they lived with grit. They just loved the idea of sweat equity. They didn't have much money in their pockets, and they could do the work themselves and be adventuresome. And we came in when people were beginning to wonder whether they needed light bulbs in closets, refinement, so to speak. And the tendency there is to just sort of get the first burst of energy gone, and then you sort of go into lethargy or let it go. And so that period was, I think, important when people were trying to figure out how to, and this was the big thing. I don't think we succeeded in it. How not to gentrify the neighborhood, in other words, make it so people who were already living there maybe had lower incomes because the buildings were terribly deteriorated. All the sort of city services were not very great at that time. And it wasn't desirable except for the location and the promise that, oh, folks, this is really going up in value when the mall gets in. We heard that from realtors a lot when we were looking for houses. But that experience of those 8 years when Frank was lieutenant governor, we lived in the Old North Side, were, for me, William, those were wonderful. It's just my cup of tea. You know, I have this social worker syndrome, and that's somebody who, that's what my training was in.
Sure.
And I never pass by an anything or a person that I don't see potential. Oh, this could be, oh, we can make this work again. Oh, this could, you know, be fruitful. Oh, this person could do well. We can figure this out. The neighborhood was like that. The neighborhood had several things that attracted me. It was an exciting house that had been one of the first that was restored there by Scott Keller. He was one of those early first pioneers into the area. It sat between boarded up buildings, vacant parking lots, the German singing choir, a house museum, and about three HUD projects, and right off of the interstate. And one of the things that made me say, yes, this is what we're going to do, was Central Avenue Methodist Church was a block away. And they had, at that time, just a new minister coming, Bob Walters. He'd been in Plainfield. He was a young guy, an ex-Marine, who wanted adventure. He was serving at Plainfield Church, and it was pretty calm and good there. But he said he'd like to be sent to that church and try to save the congregation. Well, there are a lot of big churches downtown, and the problem of all the congregation with resources to keep those big buildings had fled to the north. So what do you do with those big buildings? And big mainline congregations have wrestled with that and still are all over the country with that problem. So that was one of the issues. The other issue is you get the name of the game is building confidence and investment in your inner city. So somebody says, well, gee, I guess that I wouldn't have people throwing bombs into my house or tearing up my windows or anything else. I could invest in that place. I like the location. I like the challenge of an old house. I guess it's worth investment. You got to have confidence in investment. Mm-hmm. But when you get that and people put money in their buildings, of course the real estate value goes up. And that's a hard thing to work out within saying, well, we want to keep those neighbors who've lived here for years and who've given the flavor of this place. Another thing is that we were within 17 projects within the Old North Side that serviced people. I felt so good about that, that with these big houses that had, at that time, pretty good money socked in, doing a lot of skill and restoration, some professional people living there. And within that, we had 17, like, soup kitchens or halfway houses or medical clinics or subsidized housing, 17 of them, peacefully housed within that Old North Side. And how to keep that mix, multi-purpose use of buildings, but all kinds of people, the diversity that makes us all richer, how to keep that. And we tried to, a number of us, we had about five women who said, you know, we've drawn the line and you're not kicking all these people out of these apartment buildings. We were in those apartment buildings every month. I called it caring, sharing, and surveillance. They had absentee slum landlords, management you couldn't track because of how those scattered housing projects in HUD were distributed at the time, who owned them, who was responsible. It took us a whole lot of smart lawyers figuring out how to get to those folks and then to carry on talks about what we're doing about this. We had the second guy in control of HUD come and tell us there was no problems with those apartments. Well, because we were in them, we built confidence within the people that lived in the apartment. That was no small thing to let them know that we weren't going to come and take their kids because we thought they did something wrong, or we weren't the fire department going to tear down their building because it was didn't meet fire code. We weren't a drug dealer going to scare them out of there because they didn't work for us. To build confidence, it took a lot of working in a common place, the community garden that we built. And in that community garden, we really didn't grow very good produce. We didn't stock anybody's freezer, but we grew friends and neighbors and understanding between people who had different backgrounds. And I learned so much from many of those people who were living in those apartment buildings, who had they been born white in Carmel, with a college education, would have been doing stuff we would have said, big digs. And that was a real experience for me, having spent some years in a small town, to now have that big city experience of where they were culturally at that time. So we had to figure out, you know, what do you do about those apartments? You go in there and you get the HUD guy, what's he going to do? We had to get contracts, agreements that if people complained about the air conditioning, they wouldn't throw them out of their apartments. When they were finally turned over to a low moderate housing, and I think it was the Martin Luther King District Housing Development, that people who'd lived there for ages had time to find a housing and proper housing. To monitor that always, people of goodwill, you know, had people who thought they ought to handle things in a business-like way that maybe didn't always work with the slower process of social worker kind of people like me. So we had to keep track of all that. And in that, we were unable to keep all that low-income housing. And we had agreements about where people would be moved or not moved. And most of them moved into better houses, but not safer neighborhoods. They liked living where a lot of responsible people said, when you have a fire and the management doesn't clean it up, we'll go in and report. We know who to call about that. We know how to talk to the fire department. We know how to keep the police from towing your old truck that you love to sit in every day. Mm. You know, yeah. That kind of thing. It was, I'd learned so much living there. I just can't be appreciative enough.
Just another 30 seconds in this segment. We're talking with Judy O'Bannon, the former First Lady of Indiana. We have a question from Chad on Twitter who wonders, how can someone begin to preserve a historical location? The Ambrose Bierce home in Elkhart's fallen on hard times and is currently for sale. I'd hate for this to be razed and lost forever just as a historical marker. Chad's asking about what people can do to help with preservation if they're not already involved in a preservation group. So in about 30 seconds, what would you say to Chad?
Well, I'd say that's a question people ask all the time, and it's not easy one. There's all kinds of avenues you got to pursue. First of all, you got to say, by gum, we're making a lot of noise and bringing attention to this building or place, and you have to build a coalition of people who think that's important. Get hooked up with, like, Indiana Landmarks and say, who's your field person here? How do we try to get someone who analyzes the quality of the building, the historical significance? Bring school kids, old ladies, business people, bring them all in and look at that and brainstorm what that building means to your community.
We'll be back with former Indiana First Lady Judy O'Bannon in just 90 seconds. I'm Matt Pelzer. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. We've been spending the hour live with former Indiana First Lady Judy O'Bannon, and we've been talking primarily about her work in historic preservation. As always, when we're live, we'd love to hear your questions and comments. We're on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a short voicemail like Betty did with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881, 866-476-3881. Betty has a couple questions for Judy O'Bannon. Let's listen.
Hi, this is Betty on Eagle Creek, and I'm calling to ask Mrs. O'Bannon her favorite antique rug she has in her home. Which one is her favorite? And also, where's her favorite junk store? I bet she won't tell us that.
Favorite antique rug, Judy O'Bannon?
Well, I'll tell you, there is no favorite. They all have their own personality. And I seem to be attracted to textiles. When I travel in other countries, it's rugs I bring home. And when I feel those rugs that are handmade, I feel the energy of those people that wove them. I really do. And they have an odor. They sometimes have candle wax on them. I've cleaned a lot of them myself by hand. And they really have a life to me. But I do like junk stores. I do think it's that old social worker thing I mentioned, that everything has potential, that we can take something old and make it alive and useful again. I'm really not excited about going to new stores, new buildings, fancy hotels. I love the challenge of a bunch of old stuff in a box. And what can we do with this? What can we learn from it? What can we add? My house looks like just sort of a junk store display. But when I see things, and particularly things from the other countries, places I haven't been for a while, it brings all that back to me. I feel it again. What was it like when I was in China walking around the ruins of those old houses? What was it like in Moldova when I saw those people living in just little teeny houses in the rural areas? It brings that all back. And without those artifacts, I think my own mind that's going with my age would have lost all that.
Let's talk about the Indiana Main Street program.
Yep, for a while I was called Mama Main Street.
Yeah.
I don't have that honor title, I'm afraid, as much because I'm not that involved. But I have a real feel about small towns in Indiana.
Yeah, so you worked with Reed Williamson, who Indiana Landmarks Award is named after that you're receiving with that.
And we started that program in Indiana. I was on a committee to sort of celebrate the bicentennial of Corydon, and they wanted to have beard contests and remember old pioneer days. I said, what are we doing about tomorrow? What are we doing about the future? What are we going to do? And I had a magazine that said somebody had a conference going somewhere. You could free just sign up. So, boy, I'd go to anything that he could learn something, and it was free. He just had to sign up. So I called, and they said, oh, my goodness, that's been full for weeks. I said, well, could one of the people come and speak to us? And they said, well, they just had passed with the National Trust for Historic Preservation, just passed a policy that you had to have a state program in order to have someone come. So I called Reed Williamson, and we had a state program within months, I'll tell you. And we got those first speakers coming and talking to us about how to promote. Downtown is where everything happens. If you want to be where the action was, you were downtown. Small towns in Indiana have such an advantage. We have courthouses in the middle of 90-some of them, and it's a good gathering place. What you need is your downtown to be your meeting and gathering place. Every community needs that, whether you're a community within a big city or a small town. Small towns have been struggling. Rural towns have been struggling. They question, well, can they live through the pandemic? I think they can grow from what we're learning in this pandemic. The concentration of a lot of people in one place has some good stuff. There's more opportunities, more stimulation to do things, but it also has some troubling things, and that is that you have overuse of resources. You have more high-density pollution. You have opportunities to spread diseases. So that there's a value in spreading out, but building complete communities that function that are in our small towns. I can't think of anything more charming in my life as an old lady than to live in a little town downtown where you could open your door, you walk out, you can walk down to the drugstore, you know people, you can sit and talk, you can walk over to the library, buy a book, go to the little restaurant and sit and talk to people, you know, then go home and take a nap. Then when you get refreshed, you get up and you walk to the park and you just watch little kids play. You can't do that in most of our small towns now. They're just maybe tourist attractions or hollowed, empty buildings. We have to fill them up with things people really use, get housing down there so that people really use it. Our nursing homes anymore are on the outskirts of town. There's no way you can walk with no sidewalks into some of our assisted living facilities in Corydon. You got to get on a bus and go when everybody else goes. One thing old people don't want to lose is independence. We're an aging society. We have little towns where it's opportunities, and we worry of we get our kids really educated. Even if they live in small rural towns, they go to our wonderful universities in Indiana, and then they go somewhere else and find a job out of state. That brain drain, it's a big worry. If you're like Frank was in public office, you talk about brain drain all the time, and it's a big frightening thing. We want to let them know there are opportunities to be with people who think, who do, who ponder, who cooperate, who are diverse, and we can do it in small communities. We don't have to go just to the city and be more crammed up to be able to go to a theater, to go a learning institution, to have arts programs, to have exposure to nature, good schools, good hospitals. If we can rebuild our downtowns, and the Main Street program is a little different form than it was when we were in office. It was the largest program in the country. That was by my design. May have been a bad call, but I thought everybody ought to be able to jump in, each community, no matter how much, whether they just want to say, send your written stuff, but don't come down here ever, or if they said, we're all in. We're going to hire a manager, just like a shopping center has a manager. We're going to hire a manager, and this person's going to get paid well, and we're going to look at the design component. We're going to look at how you get organized. We're going to talk about finances. We're going to talk about programming. And we're going to put a big push. They're in Indiana now, under the Department of Community Affairs and Rural Development, I think it is. They pick stellar programs, and they give a lot of state assistance and to those who get designated that, and I think it's maybe one or two a year. It comes with a lot of financial assistance, too. Corydon is in the middle of that now. With that, they've been able to restore some very prominent downtown sort of Victorian-era commercial buildings, make apartments in them and lofts. We've been able to bury lines, utility lines. We've been able to build a park. A lot of improvements that would make it a more desirable place. Those kind of stimulus that come from government entities are important. It's also important to get town councils and county commissioners and council members to understand why moving forward with water lines, with high-speed internet, good utilities, hospitals, why all that fits in to be able to attract good minds, thinking citizens, and to make it a place where people want to live and can flourish. So the Main Street program and the idea of looking at what came before today, where are you today as a community, where do you want to go in the future, and how are you going to get there? Those are still viable questions for we as individuals, I think, but also as a gathered community. And to just look for leadership in your town who thinks that they want to get on board and have some excitement and make a change.
We're talking with former Indiana First Lady Judy O'Bannon this hour. We have another listener voicemail. This one is from Indiana State Representative Tom Saunders. He has a story about a stagecoach station in Louisville, Indiana. Let's listen.
My name's Tom Saunders. I'm from Louisville, Indiana. I have the privilege of serving in the Indiana House of Representatives. The small town I live in had a stagecoach stop built in 1845 by William Houston. We needed restoration to turn it into a community center and office, and with the help of Judy O'Bannon, we were very successful. I know I speak for the communities across the state of Indiana who find themselves in the same situation, and we are indebted to Judy's patience and persistence to save these historic buildings. I wish her the best and congratulate her on her award.
Thank you, Tom Saunders. Judy, what do you remember about that project?
Well, I just remembered, Tom, you got me to your hometown a couple times, and we had some great victories. I do remember either peeling some paint or some drywall off of walls with you, too, and the town's looking good. That whole corridor to Richmond, the old National Road, has such potential still. Historic preservation and fixing up goes in cycles. You get a bunch of people that are, yeah, we can do this. And they just work like crazy, and then they get a bunch of stuff done. They get tired and worn out. That's the natural cycle. With the Main Street program, it's the natural cycle. But you get worn out. Tom, you and your wife lasted longer than most people do. But you can't get off the roll once you're on it. You get people going, and it's hard to catch that up again. And you find areas like Centerville down the road from you that had all those antique shops and all that going, and I think that they now have slowed down. So you know that you got to keep going. You don't fix it, and it's done. You know that for sure. And your stagecoach stop sounds like a real thrill. Now, you hang in there, because that would be at least three buildings I know that are right close together that are have enough draw. You got to get critical mass, don't you? Enough draw that you get people who can come and visit.
Judy O'Bannon, what else are you working to save right now?
What am I working to save right now? Well, you know, old buildings are like old ladies. They fall down with time. You got to keep working on the ones you've already got.
Uh-huh.
And I have restored about 10 buildings over my lifetime, or been a part of it. You know, not just one person does it. You do your little bit, like those urban pioneers in the old North Side, and then the next generation builds on that. So I live in a Spanish eclectic house in Indianapolis. I have a home up there because I'm still doing television programs about communities and what communities are doing. That's just a thrill to get to travel around and go bravo with a bunch of people that are heroes in my mind. And so I have a Spanish eclectic house there. That was a whole new thing to me. I didn't know anything about those houses and how they were developed around the country as spec houses and how they grew out of the movie picture industry in the 1929s when movie industry had enough money to promote movie stars. So developers said, hey, maybe if we make that kind of houses movie stars live in, people will think that's fun. You know, buildings reflect so much of what's going on around them. First of all, they're made out of materials that come from that land. It's not a surprise that in places where they have good hardwoods, they have wooden buildings, places where they have old clay. They have brick buildings. Look at how they're made, and you know about the environment. If you build against the environment they're in, you're always on a maintenance kick. excuse me. So looking at those around the state as I get to travel around, I'm always reading the buildings. Right now we're working on a program on humor. We've been at it for over a year, but got slowed down with the pandemic. So the production itself on that tells a little bit about what we're against right now. And I think people probably need a good laugh as much as anything else because we're all tested, aren't we?
I would say so, yeah. Do you think it's more important than ever to laugh right now?
Well, it probably is, and it's a sensitive thing. I sent what I thought was a funny thing. There's somebody, Randy Rainbow, who sings these silly parodies. Sent it to a friend of mine who is quite a thinker. She is of Russian background. She's serious about everything. She's lived under Nazi regimes. She's lived under communist regimes. And she doesn't think a lot of is funny that I might. She's very much an activist. She said, it isn't funny. How can you laugh at a time like this? People are dying. She's worried and concerned about governmental issues. And it made me stop and think, we all come from a different place when we look at how to address it. Some of us are in a sad mood. One moment about Joe Kernan, I'm going to be just remorseful about times lost in my personal life, about a good man that I had hoped could live for 15 more years and contribute to society. And another part of me remembers him with joy and wants to laugh about all his baseball stories and stuff like that. So we, at different times, come to a situation with different moods, and our program on humor has to address that, and we're editing it now. We've interviewed people on there, like Jim Davis, who does Garfield, who, you know, is sort of a character of a cat, but represents many human characters, and then I did a stand-up comedy routine. I was pretty awful. But it was fun, and we're trying to address civic issues at the time in a sort of funny, sarcastic way. So we have to be careful with humor, just like we have to be careful with our actions with other people, and particularly when we're dealing with people who come from different political or ethnic backgrounds or racial backgrounds, because we haven't been imprinted. Like, the buildings get imprinted by the people that live in them. People get imprinted by things that happen to us. And what one person is able to stop for a moment and find something funny, someone else may have a deep wound that isn't ready for that. So being empathetic, keeping our antennas up, and trying to figure out where someone is so important all the time. And our program humor has to be sensitive to that.
Judy O'Bannon, we got just about a minute left. Your work is far from over, but what, I guess, is on the short list of things you're most proud of so far when it comes to historic preservation in about 30 seconds?
Well, I'll tell you, Old Centrum. I walk in that building now, and I'm not kidding. I just want to cry. It's such a joy to me. For 20 years, I worked to try to save that, first as a member of the congregation, then as a member of Landmarks, and then we documented for a television documentary that I featured and hosted and wrote a lot about. So I really invested a lot of myself in that. And during that, I mean this, I saw such amazing leadership from Gail and Bill Cook and from the Pritchard brothers and what they created. And I mean it when I say I never thought I'd walk this earth with the likes of those folks. They were wonderful.
She was Indiana's first lady from 1997 to 2003, and as we've heard, she's an advocate for saving Indiana's historic places. She'll get the 2020 Williamson Prize at the Indiana Landmarks Annual Meeting this year. Judy O'Bannon, thanks for your time and congratulations.
Thank you. Good talking with you.
I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening this hour. This is All In.